Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our discussion today is on alcohol use disorders, and our guest is Dr. Peter Friedman of Brown University Center for Alcohol and Addiction Studies. In addition to being a professor of medicine and community health, he's an established substance abuse health services researcher and an addiction medicine physician. He's published extensively on the organization of addiction treatment services, the treatment process and outcomes, and the role of particularly primary care physicians in the diagnosis and treatment of substance abuse disorders. Dr. Friedman, it is a real pleasure to have you join us. I think you're in Rhode Island.
Yes, I am. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, it's
pleasure to be here.
It's a delight, and I have to apologize in a sense before I get started to my listeners. We're very much into helping people be the healthiest they can be, but I don't think we've addressed alcohol use and abuse and consequences in the 15 years I've been doing this. So I'm glad we've got to do it, and I'm glad you published the article in the New England Journal of Medicine about a year ago, which got me onto this. So thanks very much for doing all of this for us.
My pleasure. I'm glad somebody read it.
I'm always perusing the New England Journal for trolling for things to talk about. So if we're going to talk about alcohol abuse and dependence and so forth, we need to define our terms. Would you help us understand what we mean exactly?
Well, it's sort of an interesting question at this juncture in our field. The older definitions through the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the fourth edition, made a differentiation between alcohol abuse and alcohol dependence. And this was true actually for all of the substance use disorders. There was a differentiation between abuse. And in essence, abuse was defined as a pattern, a maladaptive pattern of drinking repeatedly that's caused or contributed to adverse consequences. And these are usually social consequences, problems with relationships, interference with work, family, role obligations, arrests, or legal problems. And so those were the definitions that went into the criteria that went into the definition for abuse. Alcohol dependence was considered a more severe syndrome, and basically it was defined by having some symptoms of abuse, which I mentioned just before, but also having behavioral or physiological consequences related to a loss of control over one's use. So people who, you know, continue to drink despite attempts to stop. People who spend a lot of time trying to obtain a drink or drinking. People who give up their other pleasurable activities, those kinds of behavioral manifestations that indicate a loss of control, and there's often a sort of a compulsive pattern to the drinking. And then there were the physiological consequences, and these are the things I think that a lot of people think of as dependence. These are things like having withdrawal. So when you stop drinking, you have shakiness or nausea or difficulty sleeping, for example. Or tolerance, so people who find over time that they need to drink more in order to get the same effect. So those were the older definitions. Now we're on DSM-5, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, 5th edition, and basically those criteria have been sort of merged into one rubric of alcohol use disorders, and I was glad you opened the show actually saying that we are going to be talking about alcohol use disorders. More recent research suggests that these are really not separate disorders, but they're really a single spectrum, and what DSM-5 does is it differentiates between sort of mild, moderate, and severe alcohol use disorders. In addition, it adds a couple of other criteria to the definition, including sort of the subjective urge or craving to drink. So those are the things that we're talking about when we are saying someone has an alcohol use disorder.
Are those kinds of criteria changed in the new Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for other kinds of addictions?
Yes. It's interesting. The Diagnostic Statistical Manual doesn't use the term addiction.
Okay.
It says, and this was actually, as you might imagine, amongst the experts who were writing the manual, there was a lot of discussion about that term addiction. Typically, when we use the term addiction, we think of the more severe end of what used to be called dependence, what we now call alcohol use disorders. But it's all of the substance use disorders have these same criteria: continued use despite adverse consequences, both social consequences and health consequences. This loss of control over the use, and then the compulsive quality of it, or craving. So that's characteristic of opioid use disorders, or methamphetamine use disorders, or in our case, alcohol use disorders.
Okay. What I did not do at the beginning of the program for our listeners is tell you how to get in touch with us. I want to remind everyone, my guest is Dr. Peter Friedman. He's an established expert in substance abuse research and addiction medicine. If you've got questions or comments as we talk about alcohol use disorders today, you can reach us in a couple of ways. Our local number, as usual, is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And we do have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Dr. Friedman, what I would like to do next is talk about what's called the epidemiology, who's doing it, how much, what are the consequences, and so forth. But before we get there, we, again, have to have a little bit of definition. So if we're going to find out who's doing and how much drinking, we got to know what a standard drink might be defined as. I know in your writing in the New England Journal, you had some I guess everybody uses as a standard drink, and I thought you might share that with us.
Yeah, well, it's the standard definition of a standard drink in the United States. Actually,
okay.
The definition in Europe is slightly different. But when we speak about a standard drink, we speak about consuming 14 grams of ethanol. And what's interesting is that most of our standard ways of delivering or obtaining alcohol lead us pretty much to that amount. So we're talking about if you drink 12 ounces of beer, that's approximately 14 grams of ethanol. Same for a 5-ounce pour of wine. And it's the same for a 1.5-ounce shot of 80-proof liquor. So, in essence, we're talking about the standard pours or standard measures that pretty much will be meaningful to the vast majority of people.
You mentioned that Europe was different. I can't help but follow up on that and ask how different and why.
Yeah, it is different, and to be honest with you, off the top of my head, I don't know exactly why they do it, but I think it's a larger quantity of alcohol. I believe it's 16 or 17 grams, but I will maybe during one of the breaks I will look into that.
All right. Well, I didn't want to put you on the spot, but I'm always curious as how we're
no problem.
Different. We've been focusing a lot in this format about the differences in healthcare between us and the rest of the world, so it's on my mind. All right, so using that definition of a standard drink being 14 grams of alcohol, what do we know about Americans and their use of alcohol?
Yeah, so as your audience is probably familiar, the great majority of adults do drink. Approximately 70% of adult Americans will have a drink on an occasion. And of those who drink, about 13 to 15% of people will have an alcohol use disorder under the definition that we described previously. So of all adults, it's about 9 or 10% of adults. And been pretty much stable over, you know, the period of time that we've had large-scale epidemiologic studies. There is a considerable number of folks within that category of those with alcohol use disorders who have binge issues. That's often seen in younger folks. So we know, for example, that half of college students who drink, so 4 out of 5 college students drink, and of those 4, you know, half of them or 2 out of 5 college students actually will binge drink. So that's sort of the numbers that we're talking about.
And in your paper, you mentioned that risk drinking would be defined as an average of 15 or more standard drinks per week, or 5 or more on a single occasion for women, a little bit different for men, and a little bit less for women and people over 65. Is that still felt to be kind of the risk numbers or amount that we're worried about?
Yeah, those figures are based on, you know, large-scale epidemiologic studies that indicate that once you exceed those limits, the risk of health-related and other consequences starts to increase. We often people talk about the curve of you know, the relationship between the amount of alcohol consumed and health risks as being J-shaped. So there's the things like the French paradox, and which is that, you know, French people tend to smoke more but that they tend to have less cardiac disease than Americans, per se. And we also see this J-shape here in the States, that people who drink moderately, so at less than those limits, tend to have better health than those who don't drink at all. So that's sort of the upward-sloping part of the J-curve. To the left, and then to the right, people who drink more than that, we quickly see a rise in the health-related adverse effects, and so that's the J-shaped curve. And so these limits are based on large-scale data that, as you said, show that for the numbers are different for men and women, and for older adults as well.
And what would be, I'm kind of getting into the idea that some may believe there's definite benefits to alcohol, and maybe that is, and maybe that isn't true. So one question comes up: if there's this J shape where there's initially some risk, it improves as you take a little bit, and then starts going up again as you take more. What are the possible explanations for the shape of that curve?
Yeah, I mean it's sort of a controversial concept. Remember, this J shape comes from observational studies, epidemiologic studies that can be subject to types of biases. There's never been a large-scale clinical trial of, you know, you give, you know, you could think of that trial as being, you know, you give some people alcohol and some people not, and then you follow them over 20 years and you see who develops a heart attack and who doesn't. That kind of a study has on a large scale has not been done, although my understanding is there is some discussion of trying to do that. So we're left with observational data, and these kinds of observational data are subject to biases. So, for example, one bias that might be in place is that people who are able to drink moderately are moderate in all of their habits. So they tend to be healthier in many ways, not just in terms of their drinking. Another way in which it could be biased is that, you know, you have people, you know, 70% of the U.S. population, adult population, drinks. And if you have somebody who doesn't drink, it may be because they've had either family history of alcohol problems or problems themselves that makes them possibly less healthy on the, you know, the left-hand side of the curve. So there are a number of things that could bias that effect. And so, you know, if you go to your doctor, I think it's still relatively uncommon for a doctor to say, you know, have a couple drinks, you know, it'll be healthy. I think that just the data is not there to support us being able to make that recommendation.
What are the risk factors then that seem to come out of these kinds of observational studies on the use of alcohol that may be risk factors for moving ahead into the significant 9 or 13%, depending on which group we're looking at, of disorders that are beginning to cause either physiologic or social problems?
Well, you and I will be disappointed to hear that being male is one of them, actually. Men tend to have more problems around alcohol than women. It probably would come as no surprise that having a strong family history of alcohol problems also is predictive. That's both for reasons of environment, but also for genetic reasons. There's a strong genetic component to the development of alcohol use disorders, particularly certain types. The data also suggests that youth, you know, kids who drink earlier tend to be at increased risk for developing problems, particularly those who have had impulse control problems and other behavioral issues like ADHD or trauma in their youth, those with conduct disorder, and those who, you know, who engage in more, you know, there's a cluster of other risk behaviors that young people often find themselves falling into. And, of course, there, you know, there is the whole notion of peer pressure and who you spend your time with. And certainly for kids who are around other kids who are drinking, that also is a risk factor to initiate drinking and, unfortunately, to start to develop problems.
This is probably a pretty good time, I think, for us to take a short break. We typically do this a little later. But as we discussed, Dr. Friedman, we're going to take our break and at the same time today learn a little bit more about alcohol and its consequences. So I want our listeners to stay tuned during this break. NPR's Morning Edition just today examined why drinking alcohol is especially or maybe especially a problem for the teenage brain and the role it may play in problems like campus sexual assault. So some teenagers with little experience with alcohol in high school become binge drinkers in college while others don't. So here's NPR's Steve Inskeep, who picks up on this story.
Students drink for many reasons, of course, and it turns out one reason is that alcohol is especially enticing to the teenage brain. Here's NPR's Patty Naiman.
There's no question alcohol is a major factor in the majority of sexual assaults on campus. Federal health officials say more than 80% of college students drink, and about half say they binge drink. Think of it as a perfect storm, says Dr. Sharon Levy, a collusion of the brain's biology with a hard-to-resist environment. Levy's a pediatrician at Boston Children's Hospital.
We know more and more about adolescent brain development now, and different parts of the brain undergo development at different times in one's life.
18-year-olds are legally considered adults, but their brains are sort of stuck in adolescence, not fully developed until the mid-20s. And at 18, the time they typically enter college, the part of their brain in charge of seeking reward and stimulation is in full gear.
During adolescence, we have a period of time when kids are very highly motivated to seek extreme experiences and reward.
Without, and this is key, without the full functioning of the part of the brain responsible for judgment, the part that could put the brakes on impulsive behavior.
They're more likely to do things even though their judgment is impaired, and some of those things may be dangerous. They're more likely to drive a car, they're more likely to go for a swim. And frankly, they're more likely to, you know, have sexual contact.
Levy says if you wanted to create an environment to maximize drinking, this would be it. A brain wired for stimulation in an unsupervised environment that offers lots of it. In fact, Levy says kids who go to college drink a lot more than their peers who aren't in college.
I would say these days, as kids are going into college, they're actually expecting to drink. They're expecting that alcohol will be part of that culture. And that's because it's been highly publicized. And we've created a situation in which there is an expectation that drinking, and in fact, heavy drinking, is just part of the college experience.
It's an experience many teens just aren't prepared for. Last year, Alexa was a freshman at a West Coast college. She agreed to discuss her drinking experiences with us, but since alcohol is not legal for her or her classmates under 21, we agreed not to use her full name. Alexa didn't drink or party in high school, so it was a real shocker, she says, when she got to college and alcohol was everywhere.
You just step outside your door and there's a whole community, you know, right there. And it's easy. There's no challenge to it.
And parties where drinking games abound? No problem there either.
In college, I'd say there's probably a party, I'd say 5 days out of the week.
And even if it's not a party, Alexa says, kids drink in their dorm rooms while playing board games or cards. At first, she just wasn't interested. Then she felt other students viewed her as unapproachable, even judgmental, and that's not how she wanted to come across. So Alexa started going to parties and drinking. She got drunk a number of times and made some bad choices.
I made a fool out of myself, and my decision to fit in backfired on me in the sense that when I did become inebriated, I didn't act how I usually act, and I didn't present myself in a way which I'm proud of. I was just loud and obnoxious, and I probably was a little too honest with some people who I was just meeting, and I'm not proud of that.
Even so, Alexa says she was on the luckier side. She didn't pass out, go to the hospital, or get alcohol poisoning. But plenty of students do. More than 500,000 between the ages of 18 and 24 get injured while under the influence. Federal health officials say more than 1,800 die. Harvard epidemiologist Elisa Weitzman wanted to know why some teens with little drinking experience in high school become binge drinkers in college while others don't. Weitzman conducted a national survey of college freshmen.
The largest single factor that predicted the uptake of binge drinking for freshmen coming to college was the price they paid for a drink. Enormously increased their risk.
And in most college towns, Weitzman says the price is right.
The way the bars compete is through volume discounts. They make alcohol very cheap at the per-drink level. The bar makes money through volume.
And information about the dangers of alcohol, Weitzman found it didn't make any difference. The only factor was price. Hence, ladies' night, two-for-one night, all which appeal to underage kids who have fake IDs or aren't asked to prove they're 21 and legally able to drink. But there is some positive news. Weitzman says when colleges partner with local communities to put rules in place and enforce them to reduce college drinking, it works. Students actually drink less and report fewer hangovers, missed classes, or academic problems. Vandalism goes down. So does drunk driving and injuries. It's not clear whether sexual assault is reduced because so many cases are never reported. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Peter Friedman of Brown University Center for Alcohol and Addiction Studies, and we're discussing alcohol use disorders. Just before the break, we did something a little different and played a short NPR piece from this morning addressing how the adolescent brain and alcohol may interact to cause some significant problems, particularly in the college-age individual. If you got questions or comments about that little piece or particularly what we're talking about on the program today, you can email us over the next 30 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433, and you can always reach us through our toll-free number at 1-888-353-5752. Dr. Friedman, I know you're an internist. You're not a pediatrician, and this may be a little bit, and you're particularly interested in the addiction issues, not this binge drinking and or how it how alcohol and the adolescent developing brain come together. But what thoughts jump out at you after hearing a report like this?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I've heard said, and Dr. Ward, you're a pediatrician, you know this, it's been said that addiction is a pediatric disease that comes on in childhood or adolescence. It's a pediatric illness. And a lot of the time, the initial exposure to these substances that affect the brain's reward centers occurs, you know, during these period of adolescence when the brain is still developing. And the thing that I always say is that no one, the first time somebody tried alcohol or pills or whatever it is, they didn't say, you know, they didn't wake up one day and say, you know, I want to be an alcoholic. I think right. I'm going to go and start drinking. That's not really how it happens. I mean, what happens is these substances produce, you know, make people feel good. And, you know, in adolescence is a time where kids are often very unsure of themselves. Emotionally, it's a very difficult time. And once they're exposed to these substances that make them feel good, with some individuals, it's sort of a perfect storm of reinforcement. These are substances that produce a pleasurable sensation or reduce unpleasurable sensations like, depression or anxiety, very reliably and very rapidly. And for those who are behaviorless, that's sort of a perfect setup for the development of behavioral conditioning. And this behavioral conditioning that sort of produces the long-lasting, even in many cases, permanent changes in the parts of the brain that affect emotions and memory and motivation and learning and judgment and emotion and impulse control. So it's this early exposure that's described, you know, at a time when, you know, the thoughtful parts of the brain, you know, what we call the prefrontal cortex, is not fully developed either. So you put young people in a situation in which their judgment is impaired, they're seeking, reward and stimulation. They want to try to fit in. They're in a situation in which there's peer pressure, and it really is a setup for a lot of these kids to develop problems with these substances. But I guess one of the things, my takeaways from this is that, you know, no one sets out saying, you know, I want to become an addict or an alcoholic. It's the kind of thing that, oh, some friends say, oh, you should try this, it'll make you feel good or whatever, or they're in a situation where it's available and they're feeling left out, like that young woman in the story. And then, you know, in some people, either through, you know, genetic predisposition or other reasons, it just sort of clicks. And then in many cases, they're sort of off to the races.
You know, one of the things that caught my attention from before we took our break that you mentioned when we were looking at what are the factors, risk factors for starting and ending up in some disuse disorders, abuse, and dependence of alcohol was men, family history, which included maybe some genetic issues, and then the social stuff. And then this earlier start, and, you know, if and you mentioned along with the earlier start, the risk would be increased if you had depression maybe, or if you had anxiety issues, or maybe if you
trauma,
had ADHDs
yep.
or trauma. And, you know, all of a sudden that made a lot of sense to me. And in a sense, when we're talking about this issue during college for the first time, that kids can get into trouble, they can do things. But I really wonder how many of them really start on this long road to dependency and abuse that don't also have these other, what we might call confounding variables or increased risk variables from psychosocial kinds of issues. And that even goes back to family history. The family history may be that there is a strong family of abuse or stress or anxiety or ADHD that makes people do things that make them feel better because they so often are not feeling good.
Right.
So
yeah, so reinforcement can cut both ways. It can be both the euphoria, the feeling high, so people are seeking that high, but it also can be, you know, negative reinforcement. They want to stop feeling bad, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of kids, you know, adolescence is a very difficult time. A lot of kids have, you know, depression and other issues that they want to get away from. So either of those can be reinforcers that sort of lead them down this road.
All right. So we haven't had any calls or emails, and I'm kind of wondering, according to the statistics, which I trust very well, 1 in 10 roughly of people listening out there have got a problem or they know somebody that's got a problem, and no one's calling to ask some specific questions. So I want to remind you again, you don't have to let everybody know who you are, but this is an excellent time to have questions answered, information that you may not think is valid or you want to check is valid to call. So please not hesitate to do that. 550-8433 is our local number, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. So let me also ask about the genetic thing. This also is, to me, very, very difficult because of this confounding issue of how do you dissect out all these other potential issues. How real is it? How common is it? How many people who have true dependence, really, the real reason for that is some genetic predisposition? Are we able to really answer that question as much as we hear about it?
Oh, yeah, there have been some excellent studies, many of them using twins who've been separated, that suggest that, you know, half of dependence might be explained by genetic factors. I mean, you think about it, there are a number of things, types of genetic factors that can lead one down this road. So, for example, there is a thing called what's called the disulfiram-like reaction. So, for viewers, for listeners who are familiar with ant abuse, it's something that's used occasionally in treatment. That if you take it and then you drink, it makes you feel really bad, and that's because it blocks one of the enzymes that's necessary for the breakdown of one of the really noxious byproducts of alcohol metabolism. Well, in a lot of individuals have a relative lack of that enzyme. It's particularly seen in Asian communities, Korea and Japan, and we do see people who have that genetic factor are less likely, because alcohol is fairly noxious for them, are less likely to develop alcohol problems. On the other side, there's been some really excellent work done primarily by Mark Schuckett out in San Diego that has shown that the ability to hold one's liquor, so I'm sure we've all seen people or known people who often said with great pride that, you know, they can drink you under the table. There is a lot of evidence that having that genetic tolerance, that type of tolerance has a genetic basis. It runs in families, and that it is an increased risk factor for the development of alcohol dependence. So those are just two of the types of ways that genetics can play a factor in the development of these disorders.
Okay. All right. Well, my comment online has stirred up a couple of phone calls, so let's see if we can take a couple of those. Nick, you're on line one. Nick, are you there? I think Nick may have dropped the. All right, Mike, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, I appreciate it so much, the brilliance of the discussion and everything that you had on the programs. But I'm from Southwest Alaska, from Dillingham, and alcohol has been such a massive, massive problem. And I was wondering, you know, in research, is there any significant effort on a chemical interrupter, a biochemical stop that at least gives one a while to maybe regain the ability to think about what doing it
yourself. Mike, I'm not sure if you're still there, I understood your question. Dr. Friedman, did you understand it?
Well, I heard that, unfortunately, Mike, you broke up a little bit. I heard something about a chemical interrupter, some question about whether there is some chemical way to sort of address the problem.
Exactly.
Is that correct, Mike?
Yes.
All right.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So, and I'm really glad you asked that question. So I'm a physician and very interested in these disorders. You know, the traditional way of dealing with alcohol use disorders has been through the use of counseling primarily. Many of us are very familiar with recovery groups like AA and the use of formal counseling to try to help folks deal with some of the symptoms that lead them to drink. But I'm actually very interested in the use of medications to try to, as you say, interrupt the reward. So what we see in the laboratory using laboratory animals is if you can block the high, if you can block the good feeling that one gets from drinking, that behavior of actually seeking a drink will be extinguished. That's sort of a basic behavioral concept. And so we have medications that try to do that. One of them is naltrexone, which is a blocker of the opioid receptor. And one of the things that's thought is that there is a final common pathway in the brain in terms of how we get reward, and one of the things that is on that pathway is our endogenous opioid system. And so we use this medication to block that reward, so people who drink will drink and then not experience the feeling that they were seeking when they drink. So what happens over time is they basically cut down or stop. And so there are a number of things like that. So naltrexone is one of them, and that's widely used now in alcohol treatment. There is a medication called acamprosate, which sort of works on the reinforcement around withdrawal and feeling badly. So what often happens is people who come down from drinking feel bad, and so they will drink, you know, as they say, the hair of the dog to make themselves not feel bad anymore. So it's not so much that they're seeking the euphoria, but again, what's reinforcing is the dysphoria, the bad feeling. And so what acamprosate is thought to do is to reduce the amount of bad feeling that individuals have, and help reduce this type of drinking that people do. So there are a number of things like that are in practice being used, and hopefully more are on the way.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
All right, Mike. Thanks for your call. Chris, you're on line one.
Yeah. Hi. Good afternoon. I wanted to say, first of all, let me put in a caveat, and that is that unless you want to quit whatever it is you're doing, do not go. And then I wanted to say after that, you know, I hope it helps others, but for me it was, you know, lying to myself and saying, you know, I never drank. Not only do I not drink, but I never drank. And believe it or not, that helped me a lot. And I think it's something that people, the professionals should be looking into, is that whole thing about, you know, lying to oneself.
Okay. So you're questioning that success from abstinence or controlling these abuses and addictions are very much dependent on the individual's motivation and then honesty with themselves as factors in being successful, is what I heard you say.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and not only that, but being outright dishonest with oneself,
right,
and just saying, yeah, you know, I never drank.
Right.
And when people ask, you just say, I never drank. And studies find that people are more successful who lie to themselves.
Okay, all right. Mm-hmm. Dr. Friedman, your experience.
Yeah, so first the question about motivation. It sort of reminds me of Mark Twain's quote about smoking. He said, you know, it's easy to do. I've done it hundreds of times. I think the vast majority of patients that I see want to quit. It's just that those parts of the brain are working against them. I mean, the part of you that wants to quit, this is the way that I phrase it, is the part of you that wants to quit is this executive functioning in the higher parts of your brain, the prefrontal cortex, and those parts of the brain are relatively young. You know, they're only like a couple million years old. But the parts of the brain that are hijacked, you know, the reward system, those are seen in all animals. You know, those are, you know, hundreds of millions of years old. And you know, it's basically we're fighting against our basic nature, the reward system. I mean, the reward system that's hijacked. That's the system that helps us urges us to reproduce, right? Makes us eat, all the basic drives, and that's the system that these substances take on. So the notion of wanting. And being motivated. We often say that, you know, people, you know, who don't quit successfully the first time or whatever, are not motivated. Well, they are. It's just that they sort of lack the skills and experience and ability at this time to sort of overcome those very basic drives that are very powerful. As for the second part of the thing about using what I call cognitive tricks, like, you know, saying to yourself, I never drank, or I have a patient who every time they want to have a drink, they say to themselves, you know what, I'll drink tomorrow, right? They won't drink today. I'll drink tomorrow. And then when tomorrow comes, you can guess what they say. They say, I'll drink tomorrow. So they keep doing that. So there are a lot of things, cognitive tricks like that, that can be very useful and for different individuals. But I think part of the point of what you're pointing to is that each person, in a sense, has to find their own way, and their own way includes, you know, what it is specifically that's going to work for them. And hopefully, if you're engaged in a good relationship with a good counselor, that counselor will help you find that way for yourself.
I got an email, and let me briefly describe the questions that this person has and see if you can answer it for them. She says she and her husband both have a very strong family history of alcoholism, although neither she nor her husband drank at all during the time they've been raising their kids, so it was a distant family history, at least not in the individuals involved. And yet they have older children one's about to head off to college, so she's a little bit interested and scary, she says, about the NPR story today. So her question really does the history of alcoholism in her and her husband's family, even though they've not seen alcohol use in the household, make her kids more genetically susceptible to alcoholism?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So the the literature would suggest, unfortunately, that there is a genetic component to the development of these disorders. It can be passed down in families, and it's not purely environment, like, you know, seeing one's parent drinking or not. As you know, clearly environment does play a role. There is a genetic component, and I think this is a great question. I think it would be very in the same way that, you know, a parent should sit down, you know, at a certain age with their kids around, you know, how they're going to handle sexual activity, et cetera. I think it's very important to sit down with your kids and be very upfront about this history in your family and why it is that you don't drink, why they've never seen you drinking and why you don't. To give them information, express your concern, and let them know that this really is an issue in your family. Because when they, you know, as said in that NPR story, when some of these kids go off to college and they're in that environment, there is, a lot of peer pressure and other factors that go on. And as we said, none of these kids starts off saying, oh, I'm going to become an alcoholic. But what happens is they try it, or they, you know, get an environment in which drinking is encouraged, and then that switch that's there, that genetic switch, just sort of flips. And that's what you want to warn them about.
You know, another question that comes to my mind is perhaps asking you, if this was your child that's about to go off to college, how would you approach this education? And I know there's no one thing fits all answer, but another thought I had is I'm very much a believer in helping people understand. The more they know, the better I think they will do, especially if you're giving them good information. Is even having a 17, 18-year-old about to go off to college listen to the NPR report this morning and use that as an avenue for them to search more or to talk more with the family about their potential risks as they go off to college. Just generally, what do you think, how families should address this issue?
I think that's a great idea. I think that's an absolutely great idea. I mean, there is very clear data around alcohol and drugs and other things, that the more parents talk with their kids about these things, the better the kids will do. They're often difficult conversations. And certainly this NPR story I thought was very well done, so I think it would be a great, and I'm sure it's available online somewhere, it would be sort of a great jumping off point to sit down with one's kid and say, listen, you know, your father and I don't drink, or your mother and I don't drink. these are the reasons, this is what drinking led to in our family, you know, you're going off to college, which is going to be a high-risk environment for you, and we love you and we're concerned about you, so we just want you to know.
We can probably put a link. I don't want to do too much here and extend my ability to, but I think we can maybe put a link to that NPR story on our website today. So I'd encourage people to go to, you know, alaskapublic.org and get on the Line 1 website and see if we don't have it up there. We do have a couple of other links that might be useful as well for the listeners. Here's another question that came in by email. Please discuss the effects of late-in-life developed alcohol dependency on adults. That is, individuals greater than 60 years of age who've developed alcohol dependency later in life. So what's the effects on or risk for dementia or worsening liver failure, eyesight, rapid aging effects, and so forth?
That's a great question. And unfortunately, we do see this in this country late in life. There's commonly a lot of isolation. There's a lot of the same bad feelings, dysphoria that people had in adolescence. Those kinds of feelings often occur in the so-called golden years, which many people don't find to be so golden. And so drinking ends up being a companion and a solace for a lot of those folks. There is a significant relationship between drinking and adverse health consequences in older individuals. And I think the listener mentioned dementia. There is a significant proportion of dementia that is explained by alcohol, heavy alcohol use. There's a significant proportion of falls, motor vehicle accidents, et cetera, that is explained by alcohol. And unfortunately, it is very common. It is also treatable, and a lot of the same treatments that we use for other adults do work for older people. But often for the caretakers, this, you know, represents a real challenge. So this is something that if you are concerned about a parent or an older family member, that they might have this problem, you know, that's something that, there is help available in your community, and to try to seek out, that kind of help to try to address the problem, both through your primary care physician, also in every state, you know, there are treatment hotlines and the like, elder services, et cetera, are all aware of this kind of problem.
I know you've, from looking at your CV and comments about what you're interested in, done a lot about and looked into the treatment aspect here. And we're in our last 5 minutes. It's a big subject, but I would like you to perhaps just hit the highlights of the points you think are important for people to hear about treatment, what works, what doesn't work, your recommendations, and so forth.
Well, I think the major highlight is that this is a illness. It is a treatable illness, and unfortunately, it's still stigmatized, but that we need to work very hard to overcome that stigma and help individuals seek the kind of help that they need. We have many types of treatments that work, so formal counseling in treatment programs, recovery-oriented groups, can be effective, and as we heard earlier, medications. I am a real believer in specialty treatment, and if every state has programs that are available, these specialty treatment is designed to really provide a supportive and structured environment to really get people into early sobriety, psychosocial counseling that they need, and to really get them started with recovery and through mutual support groups. Many of the really good programs will also provide medications and address some of the medical and psychological and social problems that invariably happen when folks get involved heavily with substances. The thing to keep in mind about treatment, though, is it's not sort of a one-time fix. The way we talk about this is more like treating diabetes than it is like treating pneumonia. It's not you hear about celebrities, they check themselves into rehab and they come out and they're, you know, fixed. That's not how it works. It really is a chronic illness. And so you really want comprehensive and longitudinal care to achieve the best outcomes.
And when you say specialty treatment, I think you implied it, but you're talking about a kind of a multidisciplinary look at the psychosocial, family issues, health issues, as well as, and it may often lead to medication treatments, but it's a long-term commitment to follow up as well.
Yes, I mean, that's really what the best programs do. And when you're looking for a program for your family member, that's really what you want to look for. That it's not just going to be, you know, you come in for 28 days and then you leave and you're done. That this is really a program that's going to work with the patient over time and address these multiple other problems in a comprehensive model.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate your taking the time today, Dr. Friedman. It's been a delight having you on. I wish we had a little bit more time. I do have an email and a couple of callers that I'm not going to have time to get to, and I want to apologize to them as well. Go to our website. You have a link to the Brown Center for Alcohol and Addiction Studies there, and some information that we've provided and Dr. Friedman's provided hopefully can help our listeners who may need to address some of these issues. So thanks again for taking the time to join us, especially for a little bit later in the early evening for you back east.
It's been my pleasure, and again, thank you for having me, and I wish everyone out there who's struggling with these problems, either themselves or with a family member, I wish you all the best. And just remember that recovery is possible. It happens all the time. And keep working towards it.
Thanks again. Have a good evening.
You too.
All right. Let me remind everybody that Line 1 is going to return next Monday, September 15th at 2 p.m. We're going to have a discussion on the risks and benefits of immunizations with Dr. Janet England. She's a pediatric infectious disease expert from the University of Washington. And joining us is Dr. Roz Singleton, a pediatrician from Anchorage. So give you a chance to ask any questions you have about the risks and benefits of immunization. So why not listen or join in and learn more Monday, September 15th. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Monica Gokey is our web editor and helped engineer today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.